Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Political Science, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Susan Lee Bell at St. Joseph's University, and today I'm joined by Dr. Oya Dursun Özkanca to discuss her new book, Turkey-West Relations, The Politics of Intra-Alliance Opposition, published by Cambridge University Press in 2019. How do we make sense of Turkey's recent turn against the West after decades of Turkish cooperation and desire to be integrated into the European and wider Western community? Today's book interrogates the dynamics of the relationship between Turkey and the West, particularly the EU, NATO, and the United States. The book develops a framework of intra-alliance opposition to explain this shift from Turkey's engagement with the West as a desirable ally to Turkey's increasingly hostile relationship to the West after 2010. Moving beyond the power and personality of Erdogan, Dursun Özkanca develops an analytic framework of the politics of intra-alliance opposition and provides a comprehensive and nuanced account of how and why Turkish foreign policy has changed within the transatlantic alliance. She offers three categories of intra-alliance opposition behavior: boundary testing, boundary challenging, boundary breaking, and focuses on levels of intensity. Her three categories allow her to differentiate between the motivations behind the use of each tool. The book concludes with three possible alternatives for Turkey's relations with the West. Dr. Dursun Özkanca is the endowed chair of international studies and professor of political science at Elizabethtown College. She's edited two books, The European Union as an Actor in Security Sector Reform, published by Routledge in 2014, and External Interventions in Civil Wars, co-edited with Stefan Wolf, Routledge 2014. As a scholar focused on Turkish foreign policy, transatlantic security, European Union, Southeast Europe, and peace operations, I'm delighted to welcome Oya to the New Books Network.
Hello.
Let's start with how you came to be interested in this particular puzzle involving Turkey's change of direction in its policy and rhetoric towards the West. How did this start? When did the research begin?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a scholar of transatlantic security relations, so I have always been interested in Turkish foreign policy in the framework of transatlantic security relations. And the book itself actually was a sequel to my already existing research portfolio from, a decade earlier. And the book itself started as a completely different project, to be very honest with you. And the way it started was the book was supposed to be focusing on Turkish foreign policy in the Western Balkans. And I have run the idea by a few editors and completely came to the conclusion that it would be better to focus on a broader topic. So as you can see in the book, there is a chapter on Turkish foreign policy in the Western Balkans, but the book itself has basically embraced a much more broader scope than that, and added few more case studies ranging from Turkey's veto over NATO-EU security cooperation, Turkish energy security policies, Turkish rapprochement with Russia on security and defense affairs, Turkish foreign policy in Iraq and Syria, as well as the Turkey-EU refugee crisis. So you can see the scope of the book has been expanded as a result of my give and take with the editors of major publishers. It has been particularly challenging to write this book because as I wanted to make this a book about Turkey's relations with the West, Turkey's relations with the West was really deteriorating at a really intense speed as I was writing. And it almost felt like trying to shoot a moving target, which is an analogy that I don't normally like to use because of my pacifist nature, but certainly it felt like that. So I had to have a very flexible mentality about my approach to this book. And I had to come up with a flexible enough framework that would accommodate these fast-changing dynamics of the relationship. So that was what I intended to do as I started to work on the book. And a funny story, I went to London School of Economics as a visiting scholar in the summer of 2013, which marks the official beginning of the book, actually. And I took my 2.5-month-old son with me to London School of Economics alone as a new mom. So, but my colleagues there have been extremely supportive, and we exchanged in a lot of intellectual debates about what more needs to be added into this analysis. And later on, I have been fortunate enough to receive a sabbatical research grant from the Institute of Turkish Studies at Georgetown University to continue this research, and it finally published, got published at the end of 2019. So that has been my journey.
Actually, I was reading your acknowledgments about having the baby in tow, about the fact that it was welcoming there. It really struck me that your acknowledgments would be exceptionally helpful for young scholars. And the reason is because you credit many people who are in your subfield, many people who, you know, study things very close to what you study. You also credit people who do not, people who are with you at Elizabethtown College, who have read the manuscript. You talk about the various places that you've studied, like Georgetown, that allowed you to have yet another chance at either changing the direction, enhancing the analysis. And so I guess I just want to call out that for the young scholars listening to this who are in the midst of writing their books, this is kind of a good place to go. And I thought it was useful that you actually talked about family, that you talked about that you had your first child in tow at one point as you were heading out, and then the second one later. So I think that's really, really useful for people to think about. And as they put together the narrative of the story of the book. Let me talk to you a little bit about method, because the book depends upon extensive fieldwork. And you did more than 200 semi-structured elite interviews conducted with diplomats, with officials, with academics, with journalists. You were all over the place. You were in Turkey, Serbia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Cyprus, the UK, US, and Germany. And if I'm not wrong, some of that was also done with a child in tow. So why this particular methodology for the cases that you laid out before? You know, they're wide-ranging cases, And you've picked them, you say, because in fact, Turkey was a moving target. It was hard to figure out, like, what is Turkey? And so one case wouldn't be sufficient. If I understand it correctly, that's why the multiple cases. But why this particular methodology? How does the field work and the interviews all come together to help create the book?
This is an excellent question. Semi-structured elite interviews are not normally used in balancing studies, by the way. I have received a comment from a reviewer in an earlier version of this book saying that this is the first study that incorporates elite interviews into the study of balancing. But this is so important to me as a scholar because balancing is all about intentions as well as capabilities. So in order to really delineate intentions, I think it is really important to talk to as many elites, as many leaders, as many intellectuals as possible to be able to understand and outline what the intentions are. So that has been my thinking in terms of incorporating this methodology.
Now, so look, there's been a lot of other works in international relations that focus on the challenges to NATO and the liberal international order, but they focused more on the Cold War, on intrastate conflict, on violent non-state actors. You know, how is it that your work both builds on this scholarship, but more importantly, how is it that this presents some sort of unique contribution to our understanding of the Turkish case?
Mm-hmm. Well, we are at a very important turning point in international affairs. The international system is certainly changing. We no longer live in a unipolar world where the United States is serving as the sole hegemon. So its power is increasingly challenged, which means that a lot of countries around the world have to adjust their strategies accordingly. And NATO is the world's leading security and defense alliance. In the world, and it is the longest lasting alliance in the world, and it is still to this day has been quite successful in delivering its raison d'etre. So I think that in that sense, it is really important to look at intra-alliance opposition because alliances' health will be based on whether there is coherence, whether there is unity within the alliance. So that has been my main motivating point to see how second tier powers like Turkey are acting within an alliance that is this important and how it will it impact the future of the alliance as well.
So when in the book, when you're breaking down this intra-alliance opposition behavior, you have these three different categories. And if I understand it correctly, and I'm not an IR person, everybody on this podcast has heard me say this before, but it is the breaking down of into these three categories, and that is special, I think, about your methodology. So I'm wondering if you can say a little bit more about how it is that this method, in a sense, really is part of the contribution, not just this content about Turkey and exactly how it's behaving.
Yes, I'm glad you asked that question, Susan. I think that this book incorporated soft balancing literature, and soft balancing has done a lot in terms of intra-alliance opposition behavior. But one thing that was missing in the literature was the way some statecraft tools have been defined and have been classified based on the intensity of these tools. So what I have aspired to do and hope to have done in the book is that I classified different tools of statecraft based on their intensity. And I defined these three different categories of intra-alliance opposition behavior. And it is boundary testing, boundary challenging, and boundary breaking. So in the book, there is a Venn diagram that shows how different different tools of statecraft have been classified into these three different categories. But one thing that is so crucial to my analysis is to emphasize that there is convergence between these different categories of intra-alliance opposition. So, and there is continuum between these three different categories of intra-alliance opposition as well. The book also provides a definition of these tools of statecraft so that there is no confusion in terms of what every statecraft tool represents in terms of diplomatic and military types of behavior.
So there's some people out in the audience that don't know what soft balancing is. So give them the 101.
Yes, so soft balancing is an intra-alliance opposition behavior, and you are trying to balance your ally in this case, so which makes it soft balancing, and you are using, while doing this balancing behavior, you are using mainly economic and diplomatic means to balance against your ally, and your goal is to make your position stronger in the near term.
Oh, fabulous. Okay, that was great. Okay, so this is a case study with multiple cases. This is these sort of 200 interviews, which I want to ask you about in a second. But how much of what you say about the three categories, the motivations, the intensity, how much of that could be generalized to other cases? Like, is this a book that you intend to be contributing to the study of other cases, or is it only explaining this particular case?
No, I think that it is applicable to any other cases of soft balancing in terms of really delineating the intensity of the opposition behavior within an alliance. So it can be easily transferable. In fact, there are many studies that are conducted on that front. And there is a renewed interest right now because of the shifts in the international system, systemic balance of power. There are a lot of scholarly works that are working on the balancing behaviors of second-tier powers. And this book's intra-alliance opposition framework is easily applicable to those cases as well.
Thanks. So when you were doing these interviews, and you mentioned in the acknowledgments that, in fact, you thank those people and you have to make them anonymous, but nevertheless, you're sort of reaching out to thank them. So talk a little bit about those interviews and the extent to which you learned something about doing these interviews, or the challenges of doing such interviews in a particularly with people who might be compromised by sharing with a Western academic.
Mm-hmm. Excellent question. I think that for me, it wasn't a big of a challenge because I'm a scholar that has employed semi-structured elite interviews in her previous works as well. So I am pretty comfortable in conducting these interviews. One thing that I have learned early on is the need to be very flexible. So not everyone is going to be willing to answer your question, especially if it is going to be on such a sensitive issue. And that's why, by the way, I made the editorial decision to anonymize my interviewees' names, because we were in the middle of an emergency case, and we have had to make sure that our interviewees' identities are not compromised, because at that time, especially the Turkish government has been apprehending a lot of journalists and intellectuals, and unfortunately also dismissing a number of public servants. So I had to make that editorial decision in order to be a responsible scholar, so that I'm not jeopardizing, I'm not endangering anyone's livelihood or their career by making their names obvious to my readers. So, but yes, you have to have a very flexible mentality. Not everyone is going to answer your questions, and you will try to get as much information as possible. And you will want to also engage in process tracing as well to triangulate the information that you receive from your interviewees, because some of them are state representatives and there are certain things that they have to be talking about, and there are certain confines to their rhetoric. So you have to be mindful of that as well and run it against the empirical evidence that you can collect from additional resources.
Thanks so much. No, it's a remarkable, it's just remarkable to even imagine doing, let alone to have done it. Before we get into the book, so the book is interesting. It's really well written. As I've said, I know very little about Turkey and I'm not an IR person, but it's well written. You explain things, you're covering a lot of ground. I don't think we can cover all of the cases, but I think what we'll do is first back up a little bit and get everyone on the same page about Turkey's political history. Have you talked just a little bit about Turkey's sort of first version of itself in which it was engaging with the West, and then talk a little bit about where we are now. And then we'll talk about some of the chapters and some of the cases. But give us the sort of 101 for those of us who have not been following Turkey as carefully as you have, and perhaps are overly influenced by the moment that we are living in which Erdogan's name is everywhere, and we sort of have this understanding of Turkey as headed by this strongman politics.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So Turkey really holds a very important strategic importance for the transatlantic alliance, just simply because of the location that it is on the world map. So for that reason, if you look at any significant issue that is related to Western foreign policy making, these issues are happening in the immediate neighborhood of Turkey. So which really makes sure that we, as the scholars of international relations, place an important role on this analysis of Turkish foreign policy, as well as Turkish domestic political development. So ever since 2002, we had Justice and Development Party in power in Turkey, and they have come to power making promises about democratic reform. And over the course of years, they have conducted a number of important democratic reforms, opening reforms. However, the pace of the reforms have started to slow down with 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010. And Turkish foreign policy also made a big opening of zero problems with neighbors under Davutoğlu's foreign ministerial position. We have seen, however, that foreign policy and that initial opening up fail quite miserably. The foreign policy aspect of it really failed with the Arab Spring movement back in 2010. And we have seen that Turkey has not been able to really maintain what has been desired originally, to maintain zero problems with neighbors. In fact, I often joke that Turkey has zero neighbors without problems right now. So it is increasingly emerging as a hard power, as a regional power that is willing to use hard power. And we have seen with that, we have seen increasing tendencies for authoritarianism. And we have seen that ever since the Gezi Park movement, Gezi Park protests back in 2013, the government has been using force against the protesters. And we have seen with the attempted coup back in July 2016, 2016, we have seen Turkish government declare emergency rule. And as a result of that, all rights have been put to the side. And a lot of people, over hundreds of thousands of people, have been dismissed from their public service. Many are still in prison, and they have not been able to, unfortunately, have access to their pensions and so on and so forth. So up until this year, Turkey has been the number one country with journalists, the highest number of journalists in jail, for instance. This year only, it has been surpassed by China. So very interesting human rights implementation track on that front.
So you said that you started this book really wanting to write about Turkish foreign policy in the Western Balkans. So let's, and chapter two is in fact about that and focuses on, you know, that region's geostrategic importance to the EU, to NATO and Turkey. So tell us a little bit about your argument involving this case study, why it's so important and how it helps explain this turn that Turkey takes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that it is a great illustration of the potential avenues of cooperation within the alliance when it comes to the alliance's approach towards the Western Balkans. The alliance itself, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization alliance itself, has been highly invested in this particular region ever since the 1990s, the start of the civil wars in the region, and it has been an important responder to the humanitarian tragedies that have been taking place in that particular region. So Turkey, along with that, along with the rest of the alliance, has been one of the main proponents of humanitarian intervention in the region. So it really illustrates how Turkey can work synergically with the rest of the alliance in terms of bringing some good, some positive outcomes to the region. However, as Turkey's prospects for EU membership have become dimmer over time, and as we all know, Turkey has been accepted as a candidate country for the European Union at the Helsinki summit in 1999, and it opened up accession negotiations with the European Union in 2005, and there has been this optimism, atmosphere of optimism, that Turkey will eventually become a member of the European Union. But what we have quickly come to realize is that not much progress has been accomplished on that front in accession negotiations with the European Union. And Turkey has recognized that. And the EU, at the same time, has fallen into its own crises, such as an identity crisis, enlargement fatigue, the Eurozone crisis, economic crisis, the refugee crisis. So there have been so many crises that the EU has been trying to deal with at the same time, that Turkey and the Turkish authorities have perceived a potential vacuum, a power vacuum in the region where Turkey can use its leverage, its diplomatic, economic, as well as political leverage in the region in a way to assert in itself as a as an important regional power in the Western Balkans. So in that sense, this particular case study in the book is really wonderfully illustrating the switch, the potential switch from boundary testing to boundary challenging that EU is increasingly seeing the Turkish side as a strategic competitor.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Give us an example of the next step, of sort of next level of intensity, if this one is our boundary testing.
Mm-hmm. So if you look at Turkey's veto over NATO-EU security cooperation, you will see that Turkey, because of the admission of the Republic of Cyprus, which is not recognized by Turkey diplomatically, into the European Union, Turkey has been increasingly cognizant of the fact that the EU is more and more being ambitious in terms of creating its own foreign and security policy, its own defense, common defense policy, and so on and so forth, and that it is increasingly at odds with NATO's aspirations. So it wanted to protect the centrality of NATO in this relationship. And also, in order to become further integrated in European security and defense networks, Turkey wanted to use its veto power in NATO in a way to push the European allies to compromise when it comes to having it accepted for the European Defense Agency, for instance, associate membership. So there is this issue linkage bargaining that is going, that is taking place right now when it comes to NATO-EU security coordination veto issue. And it is causing serious headaches to our European allies and to the United States that there is this veto that says that whenever the Cypriot representatives are in the room, we cannot officially as NATO discuss security and defense affairs with the EU. And Cyprus is having the same sort of veto from the EU perspective. So it is causing a major impasse in this transatlantic security relationship. So it is boundary challenging, can be an appropriate way of saying that boundary testing is a bit, pushed aside, and we have seen boundary challenging. And the same is true with the EU refugee deal that was struck between Turkey and the EU in 2018. And we have seen that as a result of that, Turkey has become more and more confident about its role as a gatekeeper of refugees en route to Europe, and it has tried to use its increased leverage against the European Union, and this we have seen it over and over again. For instance, last year, after the book was published, we have seen the Turkish government wanting to protect the last refuge in the Syrian territory that wasn't under the control of the Assad government. And just this time around, last year, around February, Turkey unfortunately lost over 30 Turkish soldiers in the attacks by Syrian government supported by air by Russia. That has put Turkey in a really difficult position, and immediately the Turkish government used the refugee card by saying that we would like to have the European allies support us in Idlib in Syria against the Assad government. Otherwise, we are going to open up the gates and there will be a flow of refugees into European Union. Turkey currently hosts about 4 million refugees mainly most of them are Syrian, but there are also additional refugees from the Middle East and Asia as well.
So if we've had challenging and we've had, testing challenging, what's a good example of Turkey just simply breaking?
So a very good example of that is the rapprochement between Turkey and Russia on security and defense affairs. So if you look at that chapter, Turkish rapprochement with Russia, you will see that Turkey has engaged in an agreement to purchase two S-400 surface-to-air missile defense systems from Russia. Russia is a strategic competitor of NATO. So Turkey as a NATO ally wanting to acquire this system from Russia was a major no-no from the perspective of the NATO allies. And we have seen this before, by the way, when Turkey wanted to acquire a Chinese system a few years before that. In the very last minute, Turkish government has made a U-turn and decided to not to purchase the Chinese system. But the Turkish authorities have been very, very clear in terms of indicating their intentions for acquiring these S-400s from Russia. In fact, they are in the Turkish territory ever since last year. And we have seen some minor operationalizations of these S-400 missile defense systems. And the main concern on the part of the NATO allies is that it may open the gates for intelligence infiltration by Russia against the NATO defense networks. Turkey also has some NATO headquarters in its territories, and those networks are not operable. It is not advisable for them to be operating side by side. And the Turkish authorities have been saying that they are not going to be integrated into the NATO defense systems. They will be operating side by side. However, it did not really create the desired impact on the part of the Turkish authorities. And what we have seen, which is really costly for Turkish economy and for the Turkish defense sector as well, is that Turkey has been first suspended, later on removed from the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter Consortium. And Turkey has incurred real costs, real defense costs on that front. Just before the Biden administration came to power, the upcoming Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, said that Turkey is increasingly acting as not an ally, and even though it is an ally of us under the framework of NATO. So there are serious concerns in terms of Turkey's willingness to operate from and to oppose the alliance from the outside, which is my definition of boundary breaking. So boundary testing, you are slowly testing the boundaries in terms of what are the appropriate sets of behavior, expectations of behavior with your allies within the alliance. Boundary challenging is that you are slowly but surely opposing your allies, but you are still signaling to your allies that you are willing to operate from within the alliance. And boundary breaking is you are increasingly signaling your allies that you are interested in operating from outside of the alliance by forming countervailing alliances, counterbalancing against your existing alliances by entering into these types of relationships. And similar to that, Turkey has been signaling that it wants to become a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and it kind of presented it as an alternative to NATO as well as the European Union. So Turkey basically wanted to have a share at the table and wanted to be treated as an equal by the NATO allies and the European Union and the United States. But as its prospects for becoming a member have become dimmer and dimmer over time, it has accordingly adjusted its strategy in its dealings with the Western alliance. So that has been my main argument in the book.
No, and you do that so beautifully in the conclusion, because you make it, well, you've made it clear. So just for the listeners, the first chapter is really laying out the existing literature and showing where the gaps are and how it is that this framework of intra-alliance opposition would fill some of those gaps and would enhance our understanding, not just of this case, but others. And then you move to each of the cases. So there's a chapter for each of those six cases, and then a conclusion. And there you summarized it really, really well on the podcast. So that was terrific. That Turkey was experimenting in a lot of ways because they were just trying to get some sort of equity. And it's interesting to me how the book brings out that much of this came from the way that they had been treated as this sort of secondary ally. Maybe we'll let you in, perhaps you can, well, we know we really need you. And then there's this ratcheting up of Turkey's experimentation. You, in the conclusion, list these three major factors behind the Turkish foreign policy behavior vis-a-vis the West. And then you also lay out these three alternative future scenarios. So give us the short version of the three major factors, and then let's talk about those three alternative future scenarios, since we're now in that future.
Sure. So international systemic and regional subsystemic factors have been one of the factors to explain this foreign policy behavior shift, because the world is changing and Turkey is trying to adapt itself in order to assert itself as an emerging power, as a regional power, if not a world power, as President Erdogan has time and again announced. His aspirations that he wants Turkey to become a world power as well. So Turkey wants to strategically position itself to reassert itself as a regional power, to say the very least. And against the background of US wanting to pursue a more America first type of foreign policy, and against the background of European Union dealing with its own internal crises, we have seen Turkey determining that there is a significant window of opportunity that Turkey can reassert itself. So that is one factor. And the second factor is irreconcilable differences and irreconcilable interests between Turkey and its main transatlantic allies. So we haven't had a chance to talk about that yet in this podcast, but Turkey feels like it has been betrayed by its transatlantic allies, in Syria especially. Why? Because in the fight against ISIS, the Islamic State terrorist organization, Turkey has for a while been quite ambivalent in order to join that fight against ISIS. There have been hostage taking of Turkish citizens by ISIS. So Turkish government used this as an explanation for its unwillingness to engage in this fight. And while that was taking place, the United States had to be very quick in terms of deciding who would be a main pragmatic, feasible ally that can fight against the ISIS terrorist organization on the ground. And they have quickly come to the conclusion that the Kurdish allies would be the appropriate allies to engage in that fight on the ground. And Turkish authorities are making a case that these Syrian Kurdish military groups are one-on-one directly, organically tied to the PKK terrorist organization that has claimed the lives of 40,000 Turkish citizens ever since the end of the 1970s. So we are seeing that Turkish allies are feeling very much betrayed. And there is, if you look at the public opinion data, a majority of the Turkish public opinion sincerely believe that the United States and the European Union are there to divide Turkey into different territories. So it is against the sovereignty of Turkey. So there is this perception of a threat, as well as this deeply running mistrust, this crisis of trust that is taking place between Turkey and the Transatlantic Alliance. So that has been the case. And finally...
Before you go on to the finally, so are they right? If public opinion has this suspicion that the European Union and the United States are really not interested in Turkey, they're merely interested in them as a tool of their own goals and they're not listening. Is that true? Is it the case that that was a good analysis of the relationship between all of the members on the ground in the fight against ISIS and that they should have been listening? Or is... Yeah, was public opinion correct?
I believe that there is a lot of propaganda taking place, and Turkish government is also trying to shape the Turkish public opinion in a way to garner this anti-Western sentiments, because that was my third point, which is the domestic factors point. So the government... facing severe economic challenges right now, would be well advised to present the situation in such a black and white manner so that the Turkish public opinion's interest and attention would be diverted away from the economic factors that are taking place. So I would say that there is strategic considerations that are at play there.
Now, that's great. So what about the alternatives? So going forward, do we have a track that's been worn down such that people are stuck in it? Or is this something where they can change their behavior?
Mm-hmm. Excellent question. I think that there are three scenarios that are likely, but I think one of them is much more possible than the other two. The scenario one that I have examined was the continuation of the status quo. And I don't think it is maintainable. It is able to be sustained. Why am I arguing that the continuation of the status quo is not something to be sustained? The reason is that Turkey is going to have to make a choice. Sooner rather than later as to with whom it would like to associate itself. And in that particular crux, we will see Turkey, if Turkey is suspended as it is and removed from the Joint Strike Fighter Consortium, it means that Turkey will have to rely more and more on Russian technology, Chinese technology, rather than the European Union technology, as well as the United States technology when it comes to defense affairs. So I am arguing it in the book that you cannot have it all. You cannot have the both worlds. Ultimately, there will be a point in time where you will have to make that decision. And I am arguing in the book that it would be in the best interest of if Turkey would decide to go back to its allies and to reconcile its differences and to engage in trust building efforts so that the alliance's unity, coherence in the face of many strategic challenges that the alliance is facing right now is going to be maintained and preserved. So that is very important, I think. But because of these types of behavior, especially the purchase of S-400s and removal of Turkey from the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter Consortium, this is going to place a major dent in the Turkish defense sector. To give you an example, Turkey was supposed to produce the motors of F-35s, and F-35s are the exact technology that S-400s are designed to hunt down. So you can see how irreconcilable these two are. And with making a decision to operationalize the S-400s, Turkey is really signaling to its Western allies that it is willing to operate in opposition against the alliance from the outside. So there is more and more signaling of Turkey signaling its interest in terms of operating from outside of the NATO alliance. But having said that, do I think that Turkey would ever remove itself from NATO? I don't think so. But it runs the danger of watering the alliance down to a certain level that alliance is going to simply exist on the paper, and maybe the allies will find additional venues where they can exclude Turkey and engage in further defense cooperation. We don't know that yet, but it is certainly possible, because we know that the Washington Treaty does not give the alliance any powers for removing particular allies from the alliance.
Does the addition of Blinken and Biden and this very, very tightly but yet Democratic Senate have any implications for policy in Turkey? What do we know about how Biden has viewed Turkey in the past? Blinken, we've got a lot of, we know what he's been thinking. He's been around a long time. What do you think?
Yes. So I think that there was this special congenial relationship between Turkey's Erdogan and President Trump. And that relationship was partly responsible for the non-implementation of the Kaatsa sanctions. This is something else that I am also covering in the book, Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act. And just because of these defense procurement relations Turkey has with Russia, the Kaatsa sanctions were waiting to be implemented. And just before his departure from power, President Trump implemented those Kaatsa sanctions, at least symbolically, against the Turkish defense sector and its leaders, three leaders. So we see a bipartisan support, in fact, in terms of the desire, the political will to implement further sanctions against Turkey because of the path it has chosen to pursue vis-a-vis the Western alliance.
Has there any, I think you've actually done this beautifully throughout the podcast, but I'm going to ask you anyway, just in case something got left out. I mean, has anything happened since the book was published, which obviously you had to hand in the manuscript before the moment the book was published, that it either strengthens or challenges your analysis? I mean, are you happy with how the book is predicting and interpreting the things that you were not able to see?
Yes, I am 100% happy, I have to say. And I am very proud, professionally proud, but personally extremely sad as a transatlanticist, as a firm believer of the need to deeply root Turkey in this transatlantic alliance. But I have to say that the projections of the book are completely in line with what has taken place ever since the second half of the 2019. So the book itself encompasses developments up until the first half of the 2019. And then ever since then, there have been some really alarm bells ringing types of developments that took place in Turkey's relations with the West. To give you a few examples, for instance, we have seen the implementation of Kaatsa sanctions, and Turkey has been really upset by these implementation. Turkey has been really upset with the lack of support in Idlib, Syria. So that has further garnered anti-Western sentiments, both among the policymaking elites as well as among the public opinion. We have also seen, very importantly, especially this summer, we have seen the rising intentions in the Eastern Mediterranean, and we were at the brink of a hot conflict between not only Turkey and France, but also Turkey and Greece. So we have seen really seriously disconcerting issues, developments that are taking place in Turkey's relations with the West. So once again, signaling a switch to hard balancing territory, slowly but surely. So we have seen Turkey engage in an agreement of maritime delimitation with the Government of National Accord in Libya, which completely ignores parts of sovereign territories of Greece as well as Cyprus. So, and the United States, in response to these developments, have engaged in some military training exercises with Greece, for instance, in that area. So we are seeing a lot of conflict and potential for conflict. But having said that, for instance, the Turkish authorities have recently tried to engage in a charm offensive by reaffirming Turkey's willingness to be integrated into the European Union. And we have been seeing on social media all these posters that President Erdogan sent to major cities in the United States. It says, "Love Turkey." There is some attempts on the part of the administration in Turkey to try to win back the trust of the West. So this crisis of trust runs both ways. So, and I think there is some willingness on that front, which is always welcome on my part because of my own personal preferences of seeing a strong transatlantic alliance.
So you are already finishing another book, which is called The Nexus Between Security Sector Reform, Governance, and Sustainable Development, Goal 16, an examination of conceptual linkages and policy recommendations. And that's forthcoming by the Geneva Center for Security Sector Governance. So I know you've got your hands full. Is there anything else that you have already started? You know, it's a terrible question. You've just finished two books, but I'll ask it anyway.
Well, I am a workaholic, a certified one. And I, of course, started my third book ever since. I just finalized the other book, by the way. I am just finalizing, putting in the finishing touches on the second book on security sector reform. And I am about to launch a third book project, and this time about the regional changes in the balance of power in the Eastern Mediterranean. This is going to be an excellent sequel to my current book that we have discussed, Turkey-West Relations, because at the end of that book, I say that if Turkey ever abolishes the ban on death penalty, which is a red line that that is never to be crossed if Turkey wants to be ultimately a member of the European Union, or if Turkey engages in a hot conflict with one of the European allies or the United States, because there have been some threats throughout the book. I have covered those threats of a hot conflict between Turkey and the Western allies, then we are really moving into this hard balancing territory. And in this new book that I am about to launch my research into, I will be talking about the changes to the balance of power in the Eastern Mediterranean by focusing on the foreign policies of the United States, France, Cyprus, Greece, Turkey, and see what implications these different countries' strategies have on transatlantic security relations.
Well, we'll have to have you back. I've been talking. No, it's great. I just want to say, you know, again, I'm an outsider to the subfield and to the area study, but I learned a ton from this book, and it actually helped me make sense of the things that I do read in the newspaper and do process in a really comprehensive and nuanced way. So I'm really pleased to have been able to engage with the book. The book is Dr. Oya Dershan Özkanca's Turkey West Relations, The Politics of Intra-Alliance Opposition. It's published by Cambridge University Press. We will have links to buy it on bookshop.org. And we're urging you, if you can walk into your brick and mortar bookstores, to please support those independent bookstores that have had a really hard time in this last year. So, Oya, thank you so much for joining us today on New Books.
Thank you very much for having me, Susan.